Every year at the end of August, the event called Burning Man takes place in the Black Rock Desert of Northwest Nevada. Black Rock City has all the amenities you'd expect to see in any other city of 60,000 people, with bars, restaurants, bike shops, clothing boutiques, recreation centers. This year at Burning Man, I spoke with Sherry Yannick. She's the race director for the annual Burning Man Ultra Marathon. And in the second half of the show, I'll speak with the artist Miguel Guzman about the art piece representing the Mayan rain god Shock that he created along with his partner, Yvonne Koo, using recycled and biodegradable materials, including mycelium. So stick around with me, Adam Verrier, as I talk with just a couple of the participants at Burning Man. I'm Adam Verrier, your host here on Outdoor Explorer, and today we're at Burning Man. The annual Burning Man Ultra Marathon has been increasing in popularity over the years, with over 250 finishers in this year's event. So I stopped by the Pink Lightning Camp to speak with the race director, Sherry Yannick. So Sherry, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. We're here in the middle of the afternoon at Burning Man, right in the middle of the city. Listeners can probably hear that there's other things going on. We're sitting out here in the desert, and it's probably, I don't know, 85, 90 degrees out here. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Sherry, I appreciate you talking to me. You are running one of maybe the most unexpected events that a person would expect to see at Burning Man. Do you want to talk about the event that you run?
So Burning Man is a place where you bring your passion, whatever it is, to Burning Man. So, you know, if you are into grilled cheese, there's a camp for you. If you are a sexy gay man who likes to dress up in animal furs, there's a camp for you. And so I run the Burning Man Ultra Marathon. So I'm one of the leads of Pink Lightning Camp, and we're the running camp on the playa. We put on the Ultra Marathon, which is 50K. We put on a beer mile, a naked mile, a 5K, some easy runs, the Odyssey, and a couple other running events.
Okay, I came out yesterday. I went out for a morning ride to see the sunrise, and I was out on the playa, and there were hundreds of runners wearing bibs. You put on Ultra Marathon. It's a 50K event. And are people surprised when they come by your camp and see that you're running that you're putting on an ultra marathon here in the desert?
So it's kind of funny because I think it took a while, but people have heard of it by these days. I knew that we had arrived as a race when I was running one year, and someone said, "What are those people doing? A marathon or something?" And the other person said, "No, it's an ultra marathon." And right, that made me feel so good. Yeah, it's totally unexpected, but that's what makes it really special out here, and that's what makes it like no other marathon. So I like to say at the start, like, the winner is not the person who ran the fastest necessarily, but the person who had the most fun. And it's definitely unlike any other ultra marathon. I mean, you'll see people dancing, wild art cars, amazing art. There was a crew with a bunch of buffers, we call them, the buffer crew, and they dress up in neon yellow and orange, and they have all the Theraguns, and they attend to you. And
the buffers being like a big, like a rotary sander that you put a buffing pad on.
It feels amazing when you run for like 20-something miles.
As a massage.
Yes, as a massage. You'll see people are running naked. They're running in costume. We had one runner dress up like a salmon and run the entire course backwards. We've had all sorts of wild costumes over the years, but it's a place to express yourself in running and to just have a really good and a really different time.
Yeah, I think people think of Burning Man as a place to go and listen to music, go dancing, look at art. It's a huge art festival. I don't think that ultra marathoning is maybe the first thing that people think of when they come to Burning Man. But as you said, this is a small city, and people come and they have all sorts of different passions. And of course, running is a passion for a lot of people. You said earlier that that the winner isn't necessarily the fastest runner, but maybe the one who has the most fun. But you do have some really fast runners in this race.
Yeah, we've definitely had some fast runners over the year. This year, the winning time was a little slower, which is totally reasonable considering that we had dust storms for the last half of the race. It was pretty hard and pretty windy out in Deep Playa. So at one point I looked at my watch and it felt like I was running fairly decent pace, and it was a couple minutes slower per mile than I expected, just because, you know, the wind and the dust are so intense out here. I think that's something else to factor in, is that the weather, there's so many unknowns that are going to impact how it is.
Yeah, I looked at the weather the day before the race, and I think they were calling for a big dust storm coming in the morning.
Yeah.
And it sort of half materialized, it seemed like.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as I think it could have been, but it was way worse out in Deep Playa. So the race is a loop course, right? And so you do four full loops, and then you do an out and back. So the first loop was kind of perfect. It's dark, and at Burning Man, there's all these things that are called art cars or mutant vehicles. So, instead of a truck driving around, it looks like a giant bumblebee or, you know, like a train or whatever it is. And so there's all these, really creative cars. And so a lot of them have speakers. So you get to, listen and hear amazing music. So we're running through all these clubs. We're running through things like, you know, parties and listening to music. So the first lap was pretty perfect. Weather-wise, it was great. The second lap, the sun was kind of coming up, right? And so it started getting a little windier, but it wasn't bad. And the second lap is, you know, most of us are kind of still trying to push it because we want to get as much done before it gets really hot. But the third lap was just, that's when the wind really started for most of us. And it just felt like you were being pushed backwards the whole time. And it was pretty intense. And at one point, it got really dusty and there was a total whiteout and I couldn't see anything. And then suddenly I saw two of my friends. It was the aid station. So that was pretty amazing. And then the fourth lap was just even dustier, even more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I was out, I came by and watched the race for a while yesterday morning. And I was thinking a little bit about, I had ran the New York City Marathon one time a while back. And
in
the first half of the race, or actually throughout the race, you've got bands playing beside and I think that's a really common thing at big marathons. I haven't done very many of them. But here, it seems like that sort of thing is taken to another level. The people on the side of the course, as you said, buffers, sound, mutant vehicles playing music. It's a unique scene out there. I met people also who said that was an event that they wanted to do, was to be a spectator for the ultra marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really, it was pretty impressive. So I went out and I met people who, this was an event that they were gonna do. They wanted to go out and spectate at the ultra marathon,
mm-hmm.
which is a little, I was a little surprised that with so many things going on here at Burning Man, that's what people would wanna do, is make sure we get up early in the morning, because the race starts at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
I don't know if we mentioned that.
Yeah, so it starts at 5 a.m. and I've had people complain and they wanted to start earlier and people wanted to start later. And I feel like 5 a.m. is honestly the best time to do it, because most people get two laps in before it starts getting really hot. Because Burning Man can have extreme temperatures. It could be well over 100 during the day, and at night it can be in the 50s, 40s, even 30s, right? So if we do it 5 a.m., they'll get, you know, they can get a little bit of sleep. Burning Man's the worst place to get sleep, right?
Yes.
It's so noisy. Yeah. Yeah. So I think I slept 4 hours and that was really good.
Yeah.
I feel good about that. And then, you know, you can get some running in before it gets super hot, and then, you know, it's going to destroy your life as much.
What happens if you have a really extreme weather event like we have out here? Have you ever, you've been running the race since 2008.
2008. No, 2010.
2010 was the first race.
So that's my first burn was 2008. And, yeah.
So 2010 was the. Did you come up with the idea? Were you here at Burning Man and decided, okay, I think this is what I want to bring to the playa?
Yeah. So I started really running ultras and really getting into them. Like at that point, really, I was doing 50Ks and I was training for my first 50 miler at my first burn, and I just kept being like, I ran the 5K and I won it, and I ended up talking to the race director, who's a good friend of mine now, Steven, and he camps with me. And, you know, Steven he did marathons and he's Ironman, but he hadn't done an ultra. And so he was like, you know, he was like, oh, you're an ultra runner, cool. And then I just kept thinking a lot about how, so my first burn, I ended up hosting an event my very first year, which is kind of unusual.
But it is unusual.
I met somebody had posted somewhere, I don't remember, maybe it was those ePlaya forums or something, that I don't know if they still even exist, but they were hosting a library cocktail party. So my first year, I hosted a cocktail party for librarians in the Playa. And so we all
Are you a librarian?
Yeah, I'm a librarian. Okay. So there was another librarian and I, and we like made like fun bookmarks and made cocktails, and it was really fun, and it made me realize, like, you know, you can come to Burning Man and like spectate, right? But that's not the point. The point is to contribute and to give what you love and to give, you know, whatever your passions are. So that's why I was kind of like, I kept thinking about that, like, oh, I run ultras, I really want to do this. And so then my next year, I kept talking about it to my friend and talking about, like, I want there to be an ultra marathon. And I started talking to people, and there were actually a bunch of people, like, when I, after the 5K, a bunch of people were ultra runners. And they were like, oh, I'd do an ultra if there was one in the Playa. And then I went out to Pink Mammoth, and I'm dancing with this, like, really hot guy, you know, like, this is, like, really fun. And then there was this old guy with a Western States 100 miler shirt on. And I left the hot guy to talk to the old guy, like, oh my God, you've done Western? Like, I've always,
right.
You know, and at that point, I think I had just done my first 100, and so I was, like, really into it.
Yeah.
And so I was so excited by that. And so then I got back from Burning Man, and one of my friends, Rich, said to me, he said, you got to stop talking about doing this. You got to start doing it. And I was like, yeah. So he helped me the first year kind of do some of the logistics. And so then I reached out to the org and told them what I wanted to do. And they were, like, a little suspicious because I was working with the emergency services department, which is, like, medical and fire. So I ended up having a bunch of meetings with people internally about wanting to do this event and kind of, like, you know, explaining to them, like, health consequences, how it was going to kind of alleviate things. And, yeah, and so then the 2010 was our first year, and we had, I think it was, like, 41 starters and 31 finishers.
In the first year?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And how many do you think you have now?
So I need to know the starter number. I don't know that exact number, but I think it's probably over 300.
Over 300?
Yeah, about over 300, and then we had 240 finishers.
Wow.
Yeah, so we've definitely jumped up, and we're the biggest ultramarathon in the state of Nevada. Pretty cool.
Is that right?
I don't even
live here. You're at Burning Man.
Yeah.
How does that, you said that you you spoke with the org, so you, if you want to put on any kind of event, or a big event at Burning Man, there's an organization. I mean, this just isn't a gathering of people who randomly end up out in Black Rock Desert.
Mm-hmm.
There is an organization. You have to buy a ticket to come to Burning Man, and then there are events that are scheduled, and they're placed in different parts of the Playa. As a race director, how do you get a race going at Burning Man? How's that work?
So if you're doing most events at Burning Man, like right now we can hear some music from the camp across from us handing out ice cream, the Sexy Gay Men Misting Tent Ice Cream Camp,
yeah.
That's what we hear. Right, they didn't need to talk to the org, but I felt like there's certain risks that associate with doing a long distance event, right?
And there's interactivity, I guess, with other users.
Yeah, and I wanted to make sure that medical knew what we were doing, that they were cool with it, that they would be prepared. And so Burning Man has these 10 principles that guide what Burning Man is about, and one of them is radical self-reliance, right? And that means, like, I came out here in the desert, I brought enough water, I have enough food for myself, I have adequate clothing, a good place to sleep, like, all that. So part of that is all the runners are expected to be radically self-reliant. Your race fee, right, and I put that in quotes, you can't see me, but at Burning Man, there's no money exchange, but we ask everybody to contribute a gallon of water and a running snack to share, and that's what formulates our aid station, right? So somebody asked me what we're going to have at the aid station, I said, I don't know, right? Because it's so random. I mean, we had a couple runners coming over from Europe bringing Stroop waffles. Like, that, I don't know, like, every runner from Europe brought them, which is, they're great, so I was really happy about that. So it's kind of like a mix of, like, you bring everything. And we have a huge medical kit for any medical, like, issues, you know, the basic things that you're going to have in an ultramarathon. But I wanted the city to know, the city of Black Rock City is what we call it. I wanted Burning Man organization to know, we're putting this on, is it cool with you, you know, that we have your backup support of the medical staff? And we had, last year we had a runner who, during the race, left the course, went in, got an IV. He was so wrecked from the race. And then he came out and drank some ice water and finished the course.
And kept going.
Yeah, he was DFL.
Right.
But
how far behind, how far into the race was he when he had?
That was pretty late in the race. I mean, it was like his fourth lap or something.
Okay, so he was close. He could just limp it in.
But you're going to kind of see, like, a big mix of that sort, you know. But I wanted to make sure the org knew what we're doing and to be able to support us.
Yeah. Well, this is it is an extreme environment with extreme weather. Uh-huh. Have you ever had to cancel or shorten or change a race somehow?
So we've never had to cancel the race because of weather or anything, but last year we had kind of a weird circumstance. So there's those giant pink lightning bolts you can kind of see. So my husband I kind of enlisted, because what I noticed was people were cutting the course short, right, without any clear kind of like course markers. So what I ended up doing was
like not quite making it to the turn, quite going to the end.
And it's, okay. If you do a normal race, you're going to have mile markers, you're going to have ribbons. There's no place to tie ribbons. And the mile marker kind of thing, you can't just like put things out there. People will take stuff. So I decided to, I asked my husband if he would create some sort of like art piece that would be a course marker. So we have these, he's been doing it for many years now, and there are these like race gates that the runners go through. So last year, he got some help from a friend who's an artist making those, and he helped him make them. And what ended up happening was, it's Burning Man, nothing's ever on time. They were supposed to arrive a week before the race, the Monday before the race, and we got here on Tuesday, so we were gonna, you know, put them up, test them out, and everything was gonna be fine. The trailer broke down. They arrived the Monday night before the race, instead of a week before the race, a night before the race. So they were setting up those bolts in the middle of a dust storm the night before the race, right? So there's no adequate testing or anything. So morning we get up and it's not working. And these are supposed to be these lit up beacons telling us which way to run. So everybody the first loop ran an extra mile. And everybody's Garmin was exactly the same. Like, I thought you said it was 7.21 miles. That was 8.21. So then what we end up doing in the middle of the race, my husband went out and remeasured the out and back to what, you know, and adjusting for that extra mile.
Okay. Yeah, and that's, I suppose, there's probably more flexibility for those sorts of things to happen at the Burning Man ultramarathon than at probably just about any other ultramarathon out there.
Yeah, and you have to kind of be, like, accepting that these things are going to happen. I mean, sometimes we have, like, even people choosing to run extra. Like, I'm going to run over this art piece. I'm going to run over and dance at this art car for a while. And that's what makes it special. Like, that's why I say, like, awesome that you're super fast. Like, we've had some impressively fast times. Tyler Jones has our course record. I think it's 303 or 304.
303 or 304 for a 50K.
Yeah,
so 31 miles.
Yeah, which I can't even do for a marathon myself. Right. So I'm super impressed. But, like, you know, it's not just about Tyler, right? I'm celebrating him. He's an amazing runner. Really cool guy, and he's behind a camp called Belligerent Gap, and they have, like, lots of kegs, and they're an awesome group of people. But, you know, it's also about the people that, like, run the race totally naked, or, you know, wear a wild costume, or, like, are interacting with the art and route, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's such an interactive environment out here. And that's what I saw yesterday when I was watching the race. There were so many people on the side of the course, there were a lot of people cheering on the runners, that's for sure.
Yeah.
The next question I wanted to, I was thinking about, this is a temporary city that runs on a gift economy. Mm-hmm. And so you've brought this race to the Playa. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you putting on this race? I think we get something out of bringing something. And there's obviously, there were 300 and something runners in this thing. You're giving out a lot of joy out here, I think.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, you know, as I said, the principles of Burning Man is participation, right? And so you want to be giving back. You want to be creating community. You know, another principle. And so for me, so last year I had had a really stressful buildup to Burning Man. I was like, took a new job offer that I would be starting right after I left Burning Man. I just had like a lot of change in my life. And then the race was a lot, and I was so disorganized, and then my burn was awful, like a tornado ripped apart my yurt the first night, like it was just like really stressful. So the night before my burn.
And when a tornado comes through here, because the listeners may not understand how extreme this environment is, did your yurt end up kind of did it just go flying across the desert or?
So the back wall collapsed in, the roof lifted up, dropped in, and then flew away, never saw it again.
So you lost that yurt. You've never seen it since.
Yeah, my friend saw the top of the yurt on the trash fence. Luckily, all my campmates woke up to my screaming and everyone saved everything. Except for we lost our pillows, but Burning Man, we like to say the Playa provides, and two pillows just rolled into my camp that morning. I'm having this really, really hard burn. I sleep 0 minutes the night before the race, and I am so cranky, like just like worse mood, and everyone's like, oh, thank you, and I'm like, you know, like so annoyed at them, like because I'm just like annoyed at life, right?
Yeah,
and I'm like really not feeling too well, and then this guy comes up to me and he's like, yeah, he's like, this race means a lot to me. And I'm like, okay, thank you. And he's like, yeah. So I decided, like, I've run it a bunch of times. I'm going to propose to my girlfriend. We've been together for 9 years, and this race means so much. And she said she paced me the last lap on her bike. And I was like, so he proposed. She said yes. And I was like, you know, this race is so much bigger than me, right? It's like something I put on. It's a lot of work on my end, but it's an act of service, right? I'm doing it to be of service.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think that's my thing, is like, I'm gifting this because it's important to others, right? It's important to me too, but like, so many people get so much out of this. Like, I've been, you know, at camp, I was here this morning for maybe an hour and a half, and all these people were just like coming up to me, giving me hugs, like, thank you so much. Like, that was such an amazing experience. And like, you know, it's really nice to hear that and to also like realize what an impact I have, and, or rather this race. I don't want to say I, right? Like, I'm doing it, but I'm not the doer, right? And so I feel like this comes into a lot of like my philosophies in life. Like, this is my ultimate gift, yeah. And I want it. What can I do to improve people's lives? And like, this is, you know, yeah, they're torturing them with a race, but
right.
Yeah.
And did you, so you not only put on the race, you're the race director, but
yeah.
You also ran the race yesterday.
I know,
right?
Which is like, it would be way easier if I didn't do that.
But ultimately, I mean, you're a runner, so
yeah. So that's what I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I have my. One of my campmates, Christine, steps in as like the volunteer coordinator. We have a whole crew of volunteers that, you know, that like help out. And then my partner, he steps in and kind of does like a lot of logistics. And I feel like, I like to say that like after the race, he's more exhausted than I am because he's dealing with like a lot of stress and a lot of issues. So,
yeah.
Well, no, sorry. We only do that if you participate in an event.
What?
You have to participate in an event that we have. That's how we're doing it. Thank you, though.
No passport stamp?
As I said, you have to participate in an event.
Well, give us an event.
Okay, so come back later on today. We're going to do a night run at 9 p.m., a night run or ride, and you can get the passport then. So we have a ton of events. You can see our event thing right there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Are you authorized?
Yeah, I'm the head of the camp.
Who told you that?
It's me. Sometimes you don't know when people are.
I know, right? People I have the feeling.
You do realize that getting passport stamped is an activity in and of itself.
You know, yeah, but how are you interacting, right?
We're meeting people like you.
Yeah, but you're coming into our camp. You're not like trying to. It didn't seem like you were trying to engage. You went. The first question was, I want the stamp.
What's this? You have to ask him. He's the one with the passport.
Well, sorry, that's how we worked with the passport people. That's what we decided. Yeah.
We're lodging a formal complaint.
Go ahead. My name's Cherry Bomb, and you can enter that as the problem.
So Blue Cherry Bomb says you have to do an event.
You can come back tomorrow and do the kids' race.
Oh, that could be a good one. Get your running
tomorrow,
career started.
Tomorrow, 9 a.m.
I already ran the 4-kilometer marathon.
You did?
Yeah.
We're
going
to have a 5K as well tomorrow. So there you go. You can stretch it.
20% more marathon right there. We gotta go step by step. Get.
All right. Well, we're gonna check out the schedule. Pink Lightning. Over here this way.
This is. The Alaskan audience is gonna love this interview.
Oh my god. The guy that. Worked in passport. One of the runners was part of the passport program, and was like, "Oh, you want to participate?" You know, and we talked about it together. We're like, "Oh,
yeah."
The person can like participate in a program, then they can get a stamp.
Well, you know, there's an office I think over at Center Camp, which you may have heard of. There's an office I think right behind Center Camp. Somebody was telling me this, where you could. This is where you'd file a complaint, and they will take your paperwork, but they're not Burning Man. And so there's just, they're like staff. It's like, well, here's the office. And so you come in and I want to complain. Oh, we have a form for that. And you can fill it out and then you pass it in and they'll stamp your paperwork and say, well, you'll be hearing from us or you won't or whatever. And then Burning Man ends and they throw it all away. And so I think, or like, I want to change camps. Oh, we have a camp change form. It sounds brilliant.
God.
I'd love to work over there.
What is that called? The office of complaints?
I think it's like just the office. It's like, or the head office or something like that.
I haven't looked. I have to check it out.
But I think you can, like, you say, I want to do this. Oh, okay, we'll set you up with a thing. We'll get you a form. You fill it out, and we'll take care of it. So We should, probably should. I should go over and check that out. See if
unless, yeah, maybe they can file a complaint against me.
Right, right. With nobody.
I know. Oh my gosh.
Well, so we were talking about what the race means to you, and we were into something else that was kind of interesting to me, and I. but we're so tired.
I can't remember.
You know, let's see. We're talking about the fact that you run the race and that you. Mm-hmm. Oh, I know what I was going to ask you. So here we go. Is this the only race that you are a race director for? Or are you involved in other races? You're a runner of other
races.
Yeah,
I've done a couple like fat asses, you know, which are like kind of like a fat ass is like a disorganized race, like, okay, we're all gonna, no race fees, we're all gonna have a gallon of water and a snack to share, and we're gonna run this loop in the mountains, and you're not getting a prize. Like, once you've run enough races, you don't need any more t-shirts, you don't need any more trophies or medals, you're just like, whatever. And so it's just to go out there for the experience. So, you know, I've done a couple of those, but nothing regular.
Okay, no. Yeah. But you've run a lot of ultramarathons yourself.
Yeah.
I heard you say earlier in our talk that you have run... You've run a 100-miler or maybe multiple ones.
Yeah,
have you done the Leadville? That's 100?
No, I haven't done that. I'm from the East Coast. I just moved out to San Diego last year. So I've done a lot of some more East Coast ones, but I've done a lot.
Okay. Yeah. What do you, as a runner, and you not only direct this race, but you run this race. Have you done it every year that you've put it on?
So in 2018, my daughter was born on June 26th.
Okay.
And Burning Man's in the end of August. So I came here with her and... She was basically breastfeeding like every 45 minutes to an hour. So I was like, I don't know how I could do the race. So, you know, and like, because what I do is I try to run and then I manage things after I run. Because a lot of people finish their race and they hang out here for a couple hours.
Yeah.
So it's 8 hours into the race and there's a full house here, right? There's a lot of people here still. So I thought it would be taking me like 9 or 10 hours if stopping and breastfeeding and stuff. So I ran the first loop with a friend and then the rest of the time I managed the race. And I just got really bad FOMO. So the next day, I decided I'm doing my own Burning Man 50K. So I ran a lap, came back and breastfed. Ran a lap, came back and breastfed. So I think it took me, like, running time, it was, like, 6 hours. But overall time, it was, like, 10 hours or something.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, that was the only year I didn't run with everybody. But you know what? It was still my Burning Man ultramarathon. I had a really great experience. I remember, like, going out in Deep Playa and, like, meeting strangers and being like, I'm getting sunburned. And they're like, your butt's red. We got to, you know.
Right.
And, like, just, like, having, like, I had the real Burning Man experience. I had different friends run with me some of my loops. I have, like, a friend who's kind of, like, sub-elite marathoner. He ran with me for one loop. Another friend ran with me for a loop. So I had lots of company. And then before the out and back, my campmate was making burritos. So I ate a burrito and very slowly did that out and back. So,
right.
Yeah, that's the only year I didn't do it. And it just, you know, it's such a reward to do it, like, because you get to experience Burning Man in a way no one else does. You know, like, there's a lot of ways to experience and do Burning Man, and this is just a really special way to connect with people in a different way. And you get a lot of people who don't even run, but just for whatever reason want to support the race, and it's really amazing.
Yeah, yeah. With this course, you've run so many, you've run a lot of other races. I saw on the course profile, it's 100% flat, or actually the t-shirt that you have says it's 100%
totally flat.
Like, you're not climbing one foot.
But it's still not boring. Like, as I said, each loop is very different, right? You get the darkness and then you get the sunrise, and then you get the start of the day and the quiet, and then you get the heat and the chaos starting to begin.
And we're surrounded by big, beautiful mountains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on all sides.
And we're running on a dry lake bed, a prehistoric lake, which is 100% completely flat. But the conditions are always different, I think. And you're running over soft dust, but then other parts where it's baked, baked firm. So, I guess that's a good point. It's a completely flat course, but changes dramatically throughout the course of the race. And then also, I suppose, your own experience, your own experience in the race. Each lap is different because you're going to come across different people. It's such an interactive event that each lap is going to be kind of a different experience than the lap before.
Yeah, and there's, you know, if you've ever run an ultra or a race, a lot of times you, like, stop at the aid station, right? Like, I spend a little longer than you, or you spend a little longer than me, and we lose each other, so you're constantly meeting new people, so.
What would be a piece of advice that you would give, or maybe the most important piece of advice that you would give somebody who would want to come and do this ultra marathon? Like, somebody who's got experience and can run the distance, but would like to come and do this one, what do you think would be your special piece of advice for the Burning Man Ultra?
I would say, like, don't expect to PR and have that typical race focus where you're like, you know, a lot of times we put our blinders on and we're like so focused on a race. Like, you know, when I do 100, it's like the week before I'm like organizing my drop bags and like trying to, maybe I have like a little list of times on my water bottle and like, you know, trying to fit, have all my outfits laid out and everything. And like, it's not that kind of race, right? If you try to treat it like that, there's a really good chance you're going to run horribly, right? In terms of your time. Okay. And I don't, and like a lot of times you know, there's a lot of factors out here that are going to impact things, right? Like, so you might not sleep at all the night before because maybe the music's really loud, or maybe you're stressed out about waking up, or maybe you're sleeping on an air mattress in an uncomfortable tent or whatever. There's a lot of those kinds of things. It's also really hot, right? We're at slight altitude, like 4,000, I think 4, just under 4,000 feet. Yeah. So
3940.
Yes. Yeah. It is 39 something, but some people, like people who are flatlanders, you feel it, right? There's also heat. It can be really intense heat during the day, noise at night. You are eating out of a cooler, most likely. Maybe you have a meal plan at your camp and you're lucky. So you're probably not eating your usual, like, great, healthy food, you know, assortment kind of thing. And then there's this alkaline dust. So we call Burning Man, like, the surface of Burning Man, we'll call it the playa, right? Because it, like, the word, beach from Spanish, right? But it's definitely not like it's not like a typical sand. It's like this horrible, disgusting alkaline dust that you get.
Some people call it beautiful dust.
Yeah, maybe they do, but it makes you feel really disgusting. It also can impact your health. So every day I get out here early to build my camp and do stuff for the race. I always have a day where this year I had like a day and a half where I had migraines, right? Just from like inside, it like destroys your nose, your skin. Like if you walk around barefoot, you'll get cracks in your skin. It's pretty intense. And so a lot of times that really impacts people. And the dust storms, right? So yesterday we had some pretty intense dust storms for several hours of the race. And so some people dropped. The wind was so strong that, as I said, it just like felt like I was running backwards. Those are things that you don't normally think about, but you really need to.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there's advice for anybody who wants to come down run the race. I thought it was an amazing event. I was out there yesterday watching, and I was out there for probably almost a couple hours, just going from place to place, seeing all the different ways that runners were interacting with people beside the course, and the, like you said, the buffers. I didn't see any buffers out there, but I'm sure they were
great
out there.
Yeah, and there's my friend's partner does an aid station with where they bring out real coconuts and like chop off the top, and we have coconut water, and it's like just nectar out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm looking at the T-shirt that you have for this race, and these, I think, you've got quotes from that people sent you about their experience in the race, and I'm reading this here. It says, "The best running race in the world. This race changed my life. To think anything is possible, because it's the most unexpected thing you can do at Burning Man." And I have to kind of agree with that, and that's why I wanted to come over and talk to you today. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, Sherry, because this has been a fascinating conversation. And it's probably something that people wouldn't expect if they go on the internet and read about Burning Man. An ultramarathon might not be the thing they would expect to see. And I want to congratulate you on a super event. And maybe one of these days I'll run the ultra.
I hope so.
Thank you, Sherry. Thanks for taking the time.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Adam Verrier, and I'm your host here on Outdoor Explorer. In the second half of today's show, I'm speaking with Miguel Guzman, the artist who created the art piece representing the Mayan rain god, Shak, with his partner, Yvonne Koo.
Our conversation took place sometime around 3:30 a.m. with the stars of the Milky Way galaxy stretching over our heads from horizon to horizon.
I'm glad to have you with me. I'm out at Burning Man in the middle of the night. It's way past midnight, and I'm out on what's an area of Burning Man called Deep Playa. This is the part of the desert that's not developed with housing for the inhabitants of this temporary city, Black Rock City. And I'm out here with Miguel Guzman, who is an artist who has this piece of art that it stood out like I was able to ride straight across the desert to it, despite the millions of other lights that are out here. I was able to find your sculpture here on the desert, and that's saying something because you're way out here in the middle of the playa.
Thank you.
thank you for agreeing to talk to me today. This is our show, Outdoor Explorer. It's about the outdoors, and Burning Man may seem like an unusual topic for our show because it's more of a, people may think of it as more of an art or a culture or music scene, and you're an artist.
Yeah.
But I thought that being out here on the playa, like the way your sculpture is presented out here, it's completely different than being inside a museum.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah.
I've been out here with you, and I've been watching people interact with the and you with your sculpture. And
yeah.
You told me earlier this woman raised up the hands and wrapped them over the guy wires.
Yes,
and you're
yes.
Like, that's better than what I had.
Yeah,
she improved it.
Of course, that's part of the magic. That's part of the magic that people are able to interact with it. And to describe the sculpture, essentially, it's almost like a humanoid figure that is about 15 foot tall. It's got two long arms, which it's essentially almost like built like a puppet. So the arms are loose and so is the head. And it's inspired by the Mayan rain god, Chak. So the head itself at the top is Chak, and then there is masks along the front of it representing different deities for the Mayans and on the back. And then we also had another almost like a stela, about 15 feet in front of it, that is also almost Mayan, like a Mayan incense burner. And some of these elements we grew out of mycelium. So we have—
What is mycelium?
Mycelium is the root system for mushrooms. So it's almost like it's an ancient organism, but they're starting to use it instead of polystyrene and instead of plastics.
Oh.
So what we've done is we usually work with plastics, you know, because there is just so much trash in the world. But we started moving into using these new materials because we know they're not detrimental to the environment, and in the right conditions, they will biodegrade.
Okay.
So that is essentially, if from looking at the piece, I don't know, from where we are, maybe 30 feet away,
yeah,
what somebody would see. They would essentially see this strange looking creature, 15 foot tall, you know, uplit with solar lights, of course, because we don't want to pollute the planet any further. And yeah, it has guy wires. It has almost like a skirt. You know, it's like guy wires from the skirt and guy wires from the shoulder because, you know, conditions out here can be very treacherous, and I don't want anybody to get hurt.
Right. You've got the framework for this is aluminum. It's big and heavy.
Correct. Yeah. The center column is essentially 1 foot wide diameter truss. That's the stuff that they put inside concert halls to hang lights. So it's a truss tower. It has a base plate. And I've got 2 foot lag bolts, four of them, at the base of the base plate. And then at the edge of each guy wire is about maybe just under a quarter inch thick. And I've got 18 inch, they call them bull pricks, but they're essentially just large nails that we have to really hammer them in. So that's, I got eight of them.
Okay.
Eight of them holding it down because, yeah, conditions could change out here any minute.
Right. It's really an open air. It's an open air display. It's like an open air museum out here.
Correct.
Or an
correct.
Open air dance floor.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
The biggest dance floor in North America, probably at the
exactly.
tonight.
If I was doing this in a museum, I don't think I would definitely not need guy wires. I might need something just at the top, hanging it from the ceiling.
Yeah.
But yeah, it would be. And usually in museums, people don't interact with anything. They don't touch it.
Right.
But here, okay, we have to make sure that, okay, it's safe for people to touch, you know, make sure no one's going to get hurt, it's not going to fall on them, they're not going to trip. You know, at the ends of the guy wires, I've got solar lights showing where all the bull pricks are, so people don't trip, hopefully. and yeah, they don't hurt themselves, you know?
This is not your first sculpture at Burning Man. You've been coming here for a while. Yeah. How many burns have you done?
This is gonna be, I think, my seventh burn.
Seventh burn, okay.
But this is our fourth honoraria project, yeah. Which means that essentially the Burning Man organization funded us to be able to do this.
Okay.
And this is, yeah, by far the most ambitious one. You know, we've never gone that big.
Yeah. Have you had, it is interactive art. It's kind of, it's a free-for-all out here.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sculptures out here are meant to be climbed, or whether they're meant to be climbed or not, people climb them.
Correct.
Has anybody tried to climb your, to me, this sculpture does not look like something, it just doesn't look like the sort of thing that, it wouldn't be respectful to climb.
Correct.
This sculpture.
Correct. Well, they have this thing that they say, okay, if the first place you can grab isn't very stable, people are not necessarily going to try to climb
okay,
it.
Right,
so
right.
That's kind of like...
Their first grab is mushrooms.
Yeah, exactly. Or fabric. So when they go to touch it, you know, because we also reused fabric from our previous sculptures,
yeah.
You know, which is part of what we do. You know, yeah. We have to recycle and reuse. So yeah, so I would be very surprised if anybody tried to even do it because, you know, that it has a fabric skirt. And the first thing they're going to touch is fabric, which right. seems very flimsy. So.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, and you've got all the electronics in there and the
Correct.
Lights flashing. It doesn't seem like, it doesn't really invite you to climb.
No,
it.
No.
Yeah. Like, unlike many sculptures out here, they really invite you to climb it.
Oh, correct. Yeah, they, yeah. You know, they have a place to grab onto and they have steps.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I've done it myself.
Yeah. Right. So have I. I think I just came from climbing something just a few minutes ago. We're standing in front of your sculpture. And in the background, we have all this. We have so much noise, so many lights.
Yep.
How does the interaction of the other lights and the other sound work with your sculpture? Does it detract from your sculpture? Does it add to it, or is it inconsequential?
No, I think it does add to it,
yeah.
For sure. We essentially the way that the city is laid out, there is what they call sound camps. Those sound camps, well, they have like. Lasers, lighting, fire effects. So we have placed the back of the sculpture facing toward that, and because we have solar panels, you know, for the photographs, it's incredible. The lasers are shooting above.
They are
above the sculpture. So we're trying to get as many photos that we can, almost like the lasers are shooting behind it. And then when they do let off these fire effects, some of the solar panels capture the light, so it makes the sculpture blink.
Oh.
It makes the sculpture blink and some of the lights go on.
Is that why it's blinking now?
Yes, correct. Because look.
Oh, right.
There are fire sculptures.
And it blinks at the same time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And as soon as their fire is gone, okay, they go back on.
Right.
Because they're automatic.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
I know.
Yeah.
So I think it does add something that, man, if I set this up in the desert in Joshua Tree, I wouldn't have that kind of lighting effects behind it over there.
Right. There'd be no
millions of dollars worth.
right. Yeah, you wouldn't have that interactivity with the environment around it that the people bring.
Correct.
This thing.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant. Yeah. I'm very grateful. More, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. More fire, more lasers.
And so you live in Joshua Tree.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
And Joshua Tree, in a lot of ways, is really similar to here.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, the night sky, we can look up and see the Milky Way as it stretches over us here.
Correct.
I mean, it's gorgeous out here.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
And it's really similar to Joshua Tree, I think.
Yeah, I think it's very, very similar, which in a certain degree is good. In a certain degree is tricky, you know, especially trying to get the right conditions to grow the mycelium. It was hot.
Oh, so you
it
grow was, the mycelium at
correct,
home.
Correct.
How many pounds of mycelium is in this sculpture?
60 pounds.
Oh,
you know, last year we grew a chair, and the company that basically we got the mycelium from this year sponsored us the mycelium.
Oh,
so okay. We contacted them and said, okay, we want to experiment more with this material because we're trying to avoid using polystyrene and trying to avoid using plastics excessively, you know. So they said yes, and they sent us 60 pounds of already growing mycelium, which it goes through a process of growing about maybe 5 to 7 days.
Yeah.
And then we feed it, we break it up. It almost looks like a mulch. You know, it's almost like garden mulch, almost like small pieces of wood. And then once it's been mixed again, then we either put it inside molds or in the case of some of the things we did, we mixed it with gum, these kind of like gum that was good for the mycelium and made it more sticky. So it meant we could sculpt with it. But then it needed the right conditions for another 5 to 7 days, which we were growing it in a trailer in Joshua Tree with 110 degree weather outside. So I had to, we had to enclose a little tiny little room inside the trailer, and it had its own air conditioning to try to get the 73 degrees that they like. They're fighting with mold, you know, so we had to get everything really sterile, clean. And once it's almost like a biological warfare. It's incredible. Yeah. You know, the mycelium has to get the edge over the mold.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the mold will win and the mycelium will work.
Yeah.
You know, so we managed to get just the right conditions for it to, like, thrive. And then normally, you know, the people that are developing this, they suggest that we bake it. But it was so hot in Joshua Tree, all we did was take it out of the trailer and leave it outside for 2 weeks, and it dried.
Yeah.
So it becomes then, I'm not sure if it's dead or it becomes dormant until it gets the moisture and everything that it needs. And then, you know, had we let it carry on its cycle, it would start sprouting mushrooms.
What will happen to this mycelium after it's done in your sculpture? You got 60 pounds of it in your sculpture.
Correct.
So what happens after you take the sculpture down off the, does it go somewhere? Does this sculpture end up somewhere else ultimately?
Well, we're in talks of taking it somewhere.
Okay.
But it's still, you know, it's early days. You know, we have just finished building it, so there could be interest of taking it perhaps to other festivals. But I think initially we'll probably just take it back to Joshua Tree, to our kind of outdoor studio.
Yeah.
You know, the chair that we built last year has been sitting in an open carport for a year. And nothing has happened to it.
Okay, and now you have an occupant for the chair. So.
Correct, exactly, exactly. So I have full faith that in those dry conditions of Joshua Tree, nothing will happen.
Right.
I suspect that for it to biodegrade, I suspect it probably needs a little bit more, probably burying it in the ground so that the bacteria can get to it, and so it has the moisture, then it will break down.
Where'd you get the idea to work with mycelium? You have an art background. You're in theater.
Yes,
aren't you?
Correct. Okay. I studied set design and prop making. I'm a prop maker.
Okay.
But you know, because I'm a maker and I love making things, you know, and you know, so but then when I went to theater school, then I'm thinking, these materials are incredible, you know, resins and fiberglass and silicones. But then I also realizing, fiberglass won't be recycled for 500 years. And then when it starts breaking down, it's just leaching chemicals into the environment.
Yeah.
And before I went to theater school, I was decorating nightclubs with trash because I'm a trained chef. So there was just so much plastic trash, and I could see, wow, you know, this stuff is incredible. And, you know, only such a small percentage gets recycled. So then I started playing with it and thinking like, okay, maybe I can bend it and mold it and do things to it. And I was making just hanging decorations for nightclub out of trash because I knew it's very light. If it falls down, it's not gonna break. It's, you know, really not so heavy that it's gonna hurt anyone. But then on the other hand, I know that, that's one of the bigger problems that we have environmentally in the planet, you know, because we also work with scientists and I can see what's happening in the oceans and I can see what, you know, what microplastics are doing. So after I graduated from theater, once I had the opportunity to go to Burning Man, I thought, no, we must be strict. We have to be strict with our practice. So we only use solar lights. We go back to using like trash. We use anything structural. The stuff that I learned from theater school, like using trusses and rigging, I use that because I want to make it safe. And then we thought, but up to a point we were limited. And then we had heard that they're using this stuff in mycelium, and you know there's this company that they would sell you almost like the growing kits. So we thought, let's give it a shot. You know, my partner Yvonne, she was saying, maybe we should try. We should really just try, see if it works.
What do you like to do when you come to Burning Man? When you're not working on your art, are you looking at a lot of other art? Do you listen to a lot of music? Do you go?
I think that occasionally we go to some of the big sound camps, but it's not so much my thing. And I think that going around seeing the art is incredible. And there's a few artists that I've been following that I think, I really want to see how they did it, because you know we're following on social media and these kind of things. So I think you know, it's because as much as people encourage me, I would like to encourage them. You know, so it's like, if I get a chance to see one of the artists, I'm like, a couple of days ago, there's one of the artists I met at the Organic Fruit Veg Camp, and You know, I've been following, well, my first trip here, I saw her work and I thought, wow, that is just so beautiful and so inspirational. And, you know, in the back of my head, I'm like, wow, maybe I can make something for Burning Man someday. And, you know, I found her on social media and I started following her, and she was at my camp. She was at the camp next door. And I actually went up to her and I told her, oh my God, are you Valerie? She's like, yes, yes. And she was so sweet. And I told her, you know, I must tell you, you know, that, you know, since the first time I saw your work, it was just so inspiring for me. And now I'm a Burning Man artist, but I just would like to know. And she has her own story. She's a nurse, but she's also an artist. So I think, like, wow, you know, it's amazing that people have a chance to do this here. You know, like me, I'm so grateful and so humbled that, you know, and I was a chef for so many years that I'm thinking, like, you know, there has to be more to life. And then once I retrained and I had a chance to do this, I'm just so grateful.
So you were a chef first.
Correct.
And then you became a set designer?
Correct. I was a chef for 25 years. And, you know, but I was always artistic. You know, I was like, you know, high school, you know, I was at the top of the class in art. Yeah. And I always wanted to go to art school and thought, I'll become a chef. And then that'll pay for my art school. 25 years later, I couldn't do it. And I was stuck in that loop. And I was like, and that's why my friend started doing house parties, you know, almost like, you know, like dance parties. So it's like, okay, so then, you know, she invited me, and one day I was bored and I had, you know, found trash from the kitchen. I thought, maybe I can just get something, paint it with ultraviolet paint, and I hung it, and my friend was like, that's amazing, can you make more? I'm like, yeah, sure. I was hooked. After that, I was hooked. Because I love making things. Yeah. I just love making things. And then, a few years later is when I had a chance to retrain, because I thought, okay, this is my only chance. And at the ripe old age of 40, I went to theater school.
So you became a...
I became a prop maker. I'm a prop maker.
Okay.
I'm a trained prop maker. And then, I was very, very fortunate that, you know, my partner, she helped me to, like, okay, she went to art school. And then when it was my turn, she was like, well, we really couldn't afford for me not to work for, you know, for 3 years to get a BA. So we found a postgraduate, and because, you know, it was about a year and a bit. So, but because we had a portfolio of us working together and doing nightclub decorations, and we did short films, and we did all kind of as crazy things that were good, but I wasn't trained. So then, you know, I took that to the school, and I was very fortunate that, you know, they accepted me. So, but then I realized after that, thinking like, for theater, okay, it's, you know, you are not the designer. You know, unless you're the designer, if you're a prop maker, you're doing somebody else's designs.
Yeah.
But then for my own stuff that I want to make, I have to be more strict. You know, I really cannot, I don't know, after working, because we also worked with scientists. We started with bioluminescence. You know, we did bioluminescence projects, and then in the same laboratories, it's basically in Scripps in San Diego, my partner, she was filming bioluminescent algae. So then, you know, that developed into an installation that they had at the Birch Aquarium, that it was essentially a infinity cube with bioluminescence algae that we had filmed inside the lab, surrounded. So you were surrounded by bioluminescence algae, and you could see yourself and bioluminescence into infinity. But in those same labs, you could see all the scientists, they never touch plastic. They all have their own cups, almost a similar ethos to Burning Man. Yeah. And then we met one of the scientists, and she specializes in microplastics in the ocean. You know, and I knew, you know, for years, I'm thinking like, you know, this overconsumption of single-use plastics is just not very good. And talking to her, it really brings the message home that, you know, we really must be very mindful of what we consume excessively, really. Yeah. You know, the plastic is an incredible material, and it has its place in society, in medical, and, you know, in many, many applications. But just to, you know...
Overuse it.
Of course, right. you buy a plastic bottle of water, and you know, you drink it in 2 minutes, and that thing is going to be in the environment. Only 10% of it gets recycled. Even the stuff that can be recycled, that's going to be in the environment for 100 years.
Right.
So we should all be really mindful. So being in this environment of Burning Man, and, you know, part of, like, the ethos of leaving no trace and all that, we try our best to not, even though we want to carry on making things, but we don't want him to be detrimental in the long term.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, I don't want, you know, things that, aren't necessarily gonna outlive my lifetime. So, you know, I don't want to leave trash behind. I don't want to leave no trace after I'm gone.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You're your theater background was in London, or correct. That's where you were working in London.
Correct. No, I went to theater school in London.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
I don't know if I didn't catch that earlier.
No, maybe I didn't say. Yeah. Yeah, no, I was very, very fortunate that, you know, I managed to go to, arguably one of the top schools of theater in the world. You know, I went to the Royal Academy. So So and they accepted me, and like I was saying, you know, I was 40 when I went there. I was older than some of the tutors, but I was just so focused that I excelled, you know. And I don't know. I guess I got the personality and the madness to do it.
Right.
So that's how I, and realistically, it changed my life, you know. After that, because I've done plays, you know, both as a set designer and as a prop maker. So it's like, okay, I would get jobs. And then I also work for a light and sound company. And because of those same skills, some of it was transferred. So now, you know, I do love lighting. So that's why, you know, I kind of like, I have an idea of when I light what we're doing out here in Burning Man at night, it's pitch black. So, you know, whatever you do, it has to be well lit. Otherwise, you know, people are going to run into
They're going to run into it on their bikes.
Know, exactly. Yeah. They're going to get, or even the art cars, they might crash into it. So, you know, that held me to stead for many years. Okay. That theater background. Theater is incredible. It's beautiful. I love theater. But I think doing for Burning Man, you're bringing skills from, you don't even know where you bring them.
right.
Try to apply them here. And arguably some of the harshest, most challenging conditions on earth.
Yeah.
You know, even as me, as a person doing this, it's tough for me too, you know. Even like, you know, building stuff is tough, but even surviving it, you know, you go down to the real basics, you know. You know how much water you need, you practically how many calories, how much you're gonna eat, shade, you know, it brings you down to your most basic level.
Yeah.
Whilst opening your mind to some of the most incredible art and technology you will see anywhere. You
know? Well, what are your plans for tonight? You still have a few more hours, maybe before daylight. Do you head out further in the desert, or do you head back toward bed?
Well, I think I have to take this ladder back because you know, I was trying to, there is one of the lights wasn't kind of working, so I kind of tried to fix it, and I failed. But it still looks good.
Yeah.
It doesn't look too bad. It's not very noticeable. I notice it. So I probably initially take the ladder back, and then. Our crew, they went somewhere. I suspect they might be coming back at some point. Or otherwise, it's still kind of early.
Still kind of early?
Maybe I'll go and see what I haven't seen. You know, try to see a bit more of this inspiring, insane place.
Well, Miguel, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out here in the desert in the middle of the night and talk to me.
It's always a pleasure, Adam. Thank you so much.
All right,
thanks. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show, recorded in person at Burning Man. Thanks to my guests, Sherry Yannick and Miguel Guzman-Harris. A big thank you to our producer, Eric Bork. And from all of the hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, I'm Adam Verrier, and I'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.